In the Australian political scene in 2003, the Australian Greens really seemed to be the main anti-war party. They were prominent on all of the major anti-war demonstrations with some of their most prominent members kind of giving speeches. They were jumping in front of news cameras with the Greens triangles. And when George Bush actually came to visit Canberra, the Greens senators Bob Brown and Kerry Neddle almost caused a brawl on the floor of Parliament by heckling George Bush about the treatment of Guantanamo Bay prisoners David Hicks and Mamdouh Habib. Well, in the last kind of couple of months, the Greens have been somewhat sidelined because the ALP has actually seemed to be taking the fight a bit more to John Howard. I think the Greens nonetheless really remain in the minds of most people, or of many people, as the main organisation to the left of a Labor Party that's actually lost its way. And as the party that is fairly principally kind of opposed to things like war and racism and all of the things that our system kind of throws up. But how different are the Greens really? And I guess this is the talk, the content of the talk. And what I want to argue today is actually that the Greens are not fundamentally different from any other parliamentary party. And I'm going to argue that while at times the Greens have kind of jagged to the left over a series of political questions, their politics and principles are really limited and circumscribed by their populist parliamentarism and their fundamental acceptance of the dynamics of the capitalist system. And this means that actually their attitudes to imperialist war is really riven with inconsistencies and prevarications, and ultimately this leads them to capitulate to imperialism. So what leads them in this direction? What does it actually mean to say and to flesh out? What does it really mean to say that the Greens accept the capitalist system? Well, I think it's actually important to have some understanding of the background of the Australian Greens to understand their politics. So I want to give a bit of a brief history of the Australian Greens now. Well, most of the Greens parties in Australia emerged after and in response to two of the major environmental struggles in Tasmania in the late 70s and early 80s. The protest to save Lake Pedder and to stop the damming of the Franklin River. And the Franklin Dam protest in particular mobilised mass support both in Tasmania and across Australia. And this kind of victorious campaign, because the campaign actually managed to stop the damming of the river, led to the establishment of a group called the United Tasmania Group, which actually entered into Tasmanian government in a power-sharing arrangement with the ALP in 1982. And this was the first kind of Greens-ALP coalition. And its perceived success, well, in the eyes of the Greens at least, the Labor Party kind of looked back on it with horror, actually started to whet some of these early Greens' electoral appetites. And the first locally officially named Greens Party, the Sydney Greens, was formed in 1983. But these early state-based Greens formations were largely composed of bureaucrats from various environmental organisations, and they focused almost solely around the questions of the environment and around the question of nuclear power. But importantly, during this time, that was the kind of main focus of the Greens, but they largely presented themselves as neither left nor right, but for the world. And the party, they were constantly kind of talking about wanting to find a balance between these kind of hostile camps of right and left, and they even rejected categories of class altogether. And this trend was actually picked up from the kind of broader environment movement. So, for instance, the United Tasmania Group, which I mentioned earlier, actually chose the slogan, politics of left and right versus the politics of the future. And if you're wondering kind of which camp the United Tasmania Group put themselves in, it was firmly in the politics of the future. And that actually implicitly and explicitly meant rejecting being part of the left and all that that kind of stood for. So the Greens remained state-based until 1992, when they met in Sydney and decided to amalgamate into the Federal Greens Party. And early on, they really only saw themselves as a kind of pressure group to raise environmental questions in the kind of broader political scheme, to pressure different kind of political parties around different kind of questions to do with the environment. And though Bob Brown actually won his Senate seat in 1996 and the Greens had made something of an impact in the state elections in both Victoria and Queensland around that kind of period, the Greens actually only became a serious electoral force in 2001. And their rise occurred after the election of Howard and the failure of the ALP to offer any serious, genuine alternative. So actually you can start to see the dynamic that the Greens have managed to slide into the space that has opened up to the left of the Labor Party, and a space that really the Democrats failed to fill. And this was expressed in a biography of Bob Brown when the author claimed that Brown's personal charisma, which seems like something of an overstatement to me, is seen as representing the antithesis of the brooding aggression or competitiveness that lies behind much of the political speak commonly associated with politicians. So you can really start to see that people have seen the Greens as something different. They're the kind of plain speaking, away from the machine politics. They're the kind of honest party, the party of principle, the party of honour. And in the climate of kind of leftward moving ideas that we're seeing today and cynicism about parliamentary politics and, you know, all of the scandals that we've really seen recently with the Labor Party and, you know, the mock bells and gangsters and money laundering and all of these kind of things, you can really start to see why the Greens kind of have some of this kind of hold on people. So that can start to explain some of the popularity of the Greens, but what else can we kind of draw out of that really potted biography of them? And I think the first thing to say is that the Australian Greens emerged from an environmental campaign that was either explicitly hostile to working class politics or merely ignored class as a major division in Australian society. And I want to come back to the political effects of both of those things a bit later in this talk. But I think another point to draw out is that from the very beginning, the Greens have only ever seen themselves as wanting to become a serious electoral force or a proper parliamentary organisation. So they were never actually established, despite all of their posturing, as a grassroots campaigning body, no matter how they actually posed themselves. And I think that's really important to see, because for a while, for a period of time, the Greens could actually try and ally themselves to campaigns, to particular movements, and trying to use those to actually break into the mainstream, making high-profile interventions on demonstrations, having their speakers speak publicly, all of those things. That was always seen as an addendum to, you know, at best, or a motor for their entry into Parliament. So while the Greens actually managed to shoot to prominence by presenting themselves as the kind of, you know, all of the things that I said before, the grassroots, plain-speaking left alternative, that trend has really not continued. And indeed, in the last few years in particular, we've seen a really explicit shift on a lot of the Greens' kind of propaganda and material away from even that kind of nominal allying of themselves with campaigns. And there's an increasing shift towards, if you read through their website, if you read through a lot of their literature, towards this kind of language of professionalism. And Bob Brown always, in particular, talks about the party needing to become more professional, that we need more professional staff, we need to become more serious parliamentary organisation and the like. And I think a really recent example of that kind of tendency of shifting away from even seeming to kind of make nominal gestures towards building campaigns was the Greens' failure to mobilise their numerous members and supporters to go to the March 17 anti-war demonstrations. Indeed, in New South Wales, the demonstration occurred just the week before the New South Wales state election, and the Greens actually boasted about the number of thousands of campaigners that they actually managed to get to help the Greens get elected in that state campaign. So they got their campaigners to door knock, to do stalls in supermarkets, to go around and try and get the Greens elected to Parliament, but they didn't lift one finger to actually do anything to build the demonstration on March 17th, and they had a barely visible presence on that day. And I think it's, just briefly worth emphasising the importance of that demonstration in the Australian political climate, that actually, it was important, even if it wasn't going to be a mass action, for there to be people continuing to raise the horrors of life in Iraq, to be continuing to raise and push forward the idea that troops should get, the Australian troops should get out of Iraq, and to put pressure on Howard, and really to put Rudd on notice, that if he gets elected, there's going to be a campaign, a vocal and loud one, even if it's not massive. So Parliament, being one of the kind of main capitalist institutions, can actually have a really corrosive effect on the politics and progressive ambitions of more left-wing parties. In actual fact, Parliament is a game. It's a racket that almost rivals the match fixing in the world cricket. But in Parliament, the odds are always stacked because really the whole dynamic of Parliament accedes to the logic of capitalism. So playing the parliamentary game really means you have to go by the rules. And the rules are written to favour the employing classes. And the whole history of capitalism, and I'm sure there'll be lots of talks over the weekend that will detail some of this, the whole history of capitalism is really littered with the dreams and aspirations and left-wing desires of more left-wing parties. And I want to move on now to give one example of the German Greens, because I think they're really an example kind of par excellence of the corrosive effects of parliamentarism on once left-wing political forces. And being one of the only Greens parties anywhere in the world that has actually held a real measure of kind of political power, their history is instructive. I think the story of the German Greens offers a really sharp morality tale about the trajectory of the Australian Greens. Well, the German Greens emerged after the high point in the anti-nuclear and anti-militarism struggles in the late 60s and early 70s. And to cut a very long story short, and believe me, I did in my talk, the German Greens, despite consisting of a fairly kind of strange mixture of different kinds of political currents, ex-revolutionaries, Maoists, ex-kind of social democrats, deep ecologists, I don't actually know what that is, but, they were all there kind of together in this one party. Despite all of that, the Greens managed to cohere enough of a kind of left face and swept their way to significant victories in federal German politics in 1998. And in that year, they held the balance of power, or they won the balance of power, and they opted to enter into a coalition with the rightward-moving Social Democrats. And it was at this point that the German Greens actually began to shade into khaki. After the 1998 election, the business press started to really fret about German Green Joschka Fischer, who was one of their kind of leading lights. He was actually appointed as the foreign minister, and there was all sorts of, craziness in the papers. What's going to happen? This person who used to call for absolute unilateral disarmament, the dissolution of NATO, how could this person possibly be the kind of foreign minister for Germany? Won't German kind of capitalism collapse? But as it turned out, it's no wonder, German business really had nothing to worry about. And 7 months, just 7 months after the German Greens election, they decided to support the NATO bombing of Kosovo in the Balkans War. And this bombing actually killed hundreds. It meant that thousands of people were left homeless, and it totally destroyed the infrastructure of a whole entire country. And it was Fischer, this German Green, this wonderful kind of anti-militarist figure, who, as foreign minister, actually sent the Luftwaffe, which is the German, plane... What's it? Air Force? Plane system. on its first bombing missions in Europe since Hitler ruled Germany. So you can really start to see, this kind of leading light. Another figure of the 1968 student rebellions and revolts, Daniel Cohn-Bendit, who's a very kind of famous and inspirational figure, also in the Greens, supported the sending of troops into Kosovo and the Balkans. So these were fairly, as you can imagine, fairly bold betrayals by a party whose history was really embedded in the movement against militarism. And this wasn't taken lightly. And there's some funny stories, not all of which I can tell here today, but there were huge protests against the Greens from, some of their members and just more general kind of anti-war activists. And Joschka Fischer, if you ever see pictures of him, his whole kind of left side of his head is slightly askew because he actually... His eardrum was perforated when protesters threw cans of red paint at his head. So, funny, interesting, not that funny. And angry kind of anti-war activists actually trashed the Greens party's offices in Berlin. So there was a real kind of sense of anger and hostility at what the Greens had done. But despite all of that, despite that kind of mounting opposition from the left towards the German Greens, the Greens stuck to their guns, quite literally, actually, and continued throughout their almost 10 years in office to mobilise the German army in support of both German capitalist interests overseas, but also, where they could, to try and suck up to US imperialism. And really, with the whole of the machinations of the war on terror, the German states did not want to be left out of all of this, and despite the fact that they opposed the war in Afghanistan initially and nominally publicly opposed the war in Iraq, actually the German Greens fell over themselves to assure the United States that American bases in Germany would be available as a matter of course for the war in Iraq. And actually the German Greens pushed for the government to permit US warplanes to use German airspace for the war, and they also pledged special reconnaissance tanks in Kuwait, which are equipped to withstand chemical and biological weapons. And they also guaranteed that German personnel would remain aboard NATO reconnaissance planes, so if NATO was mobilised, then Germany would be, in for the kill in Iraq. So you can actually see that in practice, the German Greens have participated in the war on terror. So that kind of short biography of the German Greens' participation in the German imperialist project really highlights the really inevitable pressure that starts to mount when parties enter Parliament as serious players. The German Greens' submission to imperialism flowed from their acceptance of the primacy of German business interests, of maintaining a respectable face and their electoral coalitions at all costs. So the German Greens are really an example of capitulation, but I don't think that really explains why. And often in socialist alternatives, and for people who've been kind of around us for a little bit longer, the kind of basic answer to, why would the Greens capitulate to imperialism is, because they accept capitalism in run for Parliament, duh. And basically end of argument, end of story. And talking to a few people kind of around the trap before this talk, that was kind of, what they'd say. But I think that's actually only half the story, and I don't think it's enough actually just to say that. So I guess what I want to argue is that it's not just the fact that the Greens run for Parliament that they capitulate. Things are actually a little bit more complex than that, because in reality all parties, not all parties, but all parliamentary parties run for Parliament, but there are still differences between the parties. So there's clearly a difference between the ALP, there's clearly a difference between the Liberals, the Democrats, One Nation, the Greens and so on. So the Liberals are the open party of big business, the ALP rests on the trade union bureaucracy, the Democrats, apart from being a fairly pathetic rump, are a staunchly middle class party that is currently kind of posing left and all of that. So how can we kind of characterise the German Greens apart from saying that, they run for Parliament, they accept capitalism? Well, the Greens, I would argue, can actually be characterised as a populist party. And what does that mean? Well, historically, populist parties have swung pretty wildly between two political poles. They can be very radical, as in the case of some kind of Latin American parties, or they can be very conservative, as in the case of One Nation. And the main reason for these kind of political extremities that can still be encapsulated under the one, definition, is that the people, which is the core concept of populism, is a fairly amorphous amalgam of different social groups. So concepts like the people, by their nature, are very slippery and diffuse. And instead of claiming to represent one class with clear interests, populists have no real clear class orientation which could ground them. So the Greens' political attitudes, much like kind of the smaller Liberals that Sherry and Sandra talked about in the session last night, often base their kind of political, attitudes, policies and so on around moral categories or around what is a popular social sentiment at any given time. So the fact that the Greens have no orientation to the organised working class means that they can be kind of buffeted around like the proverbial leaf in the wind. And this means that they can either end up accepting the status quo of class exploitation, or worse, because of their indeterminate approach to class, they can end up siding with the parties of big business like the Liberals. And this trend can be seen in the history of the Australian Greens. In the 1990s, in the ACT and Tasmania, the Greens actually ended up backing, when they had the balance of power, the state Liberal government. And they justified this by saying that they had to power share and be responsible and all of the, things that we've kind of talked about a little bit already. And while in this kind of power sharing arrangement, actually in the ACT, the Greens supported the privatisation of a number of nursing homes, and they expressed no principled opposition to the corporatisation of ACT electricity and water. So this actually had, for all the old people in the old people's homes, their living standards were going down massively, and water and electricity became much more expensive in the Australian Capital Territory for ordinary working people as a result of the Greens' policies. But more recently, perhaps in more people's living memory, although the 1990s, not so far away, in Victoria and New South Wales, in the state elections, a number of Greens, in the different kinds of seats around the place, actually refused to preference the ALP first. So they left open their preference distributions on their how-to-vote cards, really just telling their supporters they could kind of vote either way. And this effectively allows the Liberals to get a foothold. And in the context, really, of 10 awful and difficult years of John Howard and this kind of mass campaign across Australia to kick out Howard, think the Greens not demanding that actually all of their supporters and voters put the Liberal last was absolutely criminal. But I think more than being a total outrage, and hopefully everyone is totally outraged, I think this behaviour reveals that the Greens don't always take a principled stand against big capital and their parties. And this means that when it comes to wars and imperialism, the Greens don't have as their starting point immediate and unequivocal hostility to anything that the Liberals or the bosses propose. And it means that they can't recognise that these forces will only ever make proposals either within Australia or outside of Australia that will back up Australian business and military interests and will never do anything to make the lives of workers and the poor in Australia, Iraq or the Pacific region any better. So another significant element of populist politics is its slide internationalism. The Greens often claim to represent what is best for the Australian people, and this leads to the notion that there's some kind of sticky, emotional, cultural or historical kind of ties or glue that binds all Australians together, regardless of class, race, sexuality, history, whether we're immigrants, whether we're not, whether we're women, whether men, whatever, that there is some kind of national interest that can be and should be represented. And one of the most revealing statements by Bob Brown was at an anti-war rally against the war in Iraq in Sydney in 2003 when he said, "No matter what, this is George Bush's war. This is not Australia's war." And Brown and others in the party have really consistently stated and maintained that the Australian troop presence should not be in Iraq. It should be in the Australian region where they're needed. So in other words, the Greens' opposition to war is not derived from any serious opposition to the violent kind of eruptions of US imperialism and the drive by the major powers for a redivision of the Middle East, but an estimation that it's not in Australia's interests. So the clear implication with all of those kind of statements is that if it was in Australia's interests, then all of the barbarity, all of the butchery, all of the bloodshed that's going on in Iraq today would be absolutely kind of condoned. So, this means that the Greens actively, you know, that acceptance of the idea of a kind of national unity, that there's one national interest and so on, means that the Greens actually actively campaign for the Australian military to play a role in the region. And they supported the Australian military presence in the Solomons and East Timor, and they've had a fairly equivocal position on the recent Australian crushing of pro-democracy protests in Tonga. And they support these interventions by claiming to be for stability in the region. But I think we really have to be clear that stability in these kind of contexts means stability for Australian business. It means maintaining stable trade routes through the Pacific Islands and through the Malacca Straits. It means stability for Australian businesses to set up shop in some of these tiny nations. It means easy, stable imposition of Australian legal, political norms in some of these places, Australian police forces, Australian bureaucracies, Australian heads, Australian lawyers. It means stabilising the local populations when they seem to be resisting, Australia basically plundering and looting their natural resources. That's what stability means. And really, genuine anti-imperialist forces would reject entirely this notion of free market capitalist stability. And we'd reject it on the basis that it's not good for either the people of the various islands of the Pacific, nor is it good for the working people of Australia. And in these sorts of instances, it is pretty clear that the Greens not only capitulate to imperialism, but they're actively for Australian imperialism in the name of our national interest. So, what's more, I think really the idea of putting the Australian national interest, which essentially means Australian business first, front and centre, means that the Greens end up conceding to the Australian-American alliance and all that stands for. And this can lead, at times, to a certain equivocation when it comes to condemning every single American imperialist military adventure that occurs across the world. They say, well, we have to judge each one as it comes. We have to kind of, you know, assess it on its merits and, you know, try and see which we support and which we don't. And after all, why would they think anything different? Because really, Bob Brown has consistently said, and this is his words exactly, that Australia should do all it can to maintain its historically close and friendly ties with the American government. And that kind of political muddiness means that they can be drawn into accepting the various kind of different rationales for imperialist wars. Because, well, if you have to judge everything according to the kind of logic of, you know, oh, well, what are they saying about it? What's it for? All of these kind of things actually means that they can start to accept that there are particular good reasons for wars to happen or not. So though the Greens actually oppose the initial invasion of Iraq, the kind of occupation of Iraq, Bob Brown openly said that he supported the initial missile strike of Baghdad because it might just kill off Saddam Hussein quickly. So, you know, in the context of actually, you know, these kind of missile strikes not only killing a lot of other Iraqi people, they obviously clearly accepted that, well, you know, maybe this bombing is about actually, you know, toppling Saddam, toppling a dictator, all of these kind of things. So they got sucked in to that kind of argument. And currently, the Greens refuse to unequivocally come out in opposition to the war on terror. They largely accept that we have to fight terrorists, and this leads them into a variety of concessions and capitulations. So, for instance, in the lead-up to the war in Afghanistan, Bob Brown made no mention of opposition to the war under any circumstances. As US, British and Australian troops were pouring into Afghanistan, he made a statement claiming that the invasion was not a war, but a hunt for terrorists. And in fact, Brown said he would support sending troops so long as they were, in his words, under the auspices of the United Nations. As though it actually makes any difference to the thousands upon thousands of Afghanis whose lives have been destroyed by the consistent bombardment and military presence of the US forces, whether they're backed by the UN or not. And these forces, their guns, their martial law, their bans on protests, their attacks on the freedom of assembly exist. They all still exist, regardless of whether or not they're backed by the UN, whether or not they're sanctioned by Europe, whether they're backed by NATO or not. For the Afghanis, one oppressive set of rulers and warlords not backed by the US has actually just been replaced by another set of rulers and warlords that are not backed, that are currently backed by the US. So we have to be clear that the war on Afghanistan, just as much as the war in Iraq, is about US imperialism. And despite the fact that it's being given the tick of approval from more kind of countries and the UN. So while the Greens have actually, you know, to give them their due, taken a bit more of a public stand against the war in Iraq, their refusal to condemn the whole of the war on terror as nothing but an excuse for imperialism means they're really incapable of consistently opposing the ways that the war on terror is mobilised within Australia to whip up anti-Muslim racism, to curtail civil liberties and attack our rights. And perhaps the most shocking of these capitulations was Bob Brown's comments on Sheikh Al-Hilali. Because since the beginning of the war on terror, as people might know, there's been a huge kind of campaign and attempt to vilify different kind of clerics, particularly the kind of more radical anti-Western clerics. But the media, you know, I think it was last year, actually managed to dig up what was clearly an outrageously sexist comment from the Sheikh. But in the mouth-frothing frenzy that kind of ensued, the ALP and the Liberals actually started to kind of create a more general kind of, you know, maelstrom against Muslims in Australia. But instead of kind of, you know, Bob Brown coming out and saying, well, you know, we're taking a stand against the racism, we condemn the Howard government, instead of saying that, actually, Bob Brown took up what I think was the best of Sheikh Al-Hilali's comments, which was when he said that actually he would only resign from being Mufti of Australia when the world was clean of the White House. And it was that comment, not the sexist comment, that made Bob Brown's blood boil. It's a lot of bees. And he described in his statement that this was an unacceptable, those kind of comments were unacceptable in a democratic society. And comments like that about the White House means that the Mufti is not thinking about democracy. And if the White House is the centre of democracy in the world, then, you know, really I think we have to start to question what we're doing here. But despite the fact, again, that the Greens have been more outspoken around the questions of the situation of David Hicks than almost any other kind of major opposition force in Australia, their position on what should happen to him actually, again, reveals the limits of Green politics. Bob Brown, when speaking at a demonstration against Hicks's incarceration, told the crowd that Hicks should be brought home and tried in Australia because Australia has one of the best and fairest legal systems in the world. Well, I think really, like, try telling that to Jack Thomas, who was incarcerated in solitary confinement for month after month under the new anti-terror legislation, who was tried in a court that attempted to admit evidence that was got under torture, and who actually, after being acquitted of all major charges to do with terrorism, who was then put under court order to remain in his house, had all his phone calls bugged, had all his liberty of, you know, just going around Australia wherever he wanted, totally curtailed. And the kind of repression, when that happens overseas, in somewhere like Burma, for instance, where the pro-democracy campaigner Aung San Suu Kyi has actually been held in quite similar kind of, you know, house arrest conditions, is absolutely condemned by the Greens. But in Australia, when it happens, this is not taken as evidence of the kind of deepest rot in the Australian legal system. It's rather kind of glossed over in a fit of self-congratulatory nationalism. But really, maybe it's a little too much to expect that the Greens would condemn the whole Australian legal system when they can't even make a decent fist of opposing the new anti-terrorism laws. And in fact, the Green senators, the federal senators, did not actually vote against the government's emergency anti-terror legislation. So in November of 2005, amid very lurid kind of warnings by the Howard government of imminent terrorist threat, imminent terrorist attacks, Howard recalled Parliament to ram through the first instalment of these kind of new anti-terrorism laws. And while protesting, and you can read some of the comments that the Greens actually made in Parliament, they protest very verbally and passionately about, you know, the kind of undemocratic manipulation of Parliament by Howard. But when push came to shove, they actually refused to vote against the bill. And I think Bob Brown's speech on the anti-terror legislation really reveals the problem. And he said, "This legislation is a political document much more than a defence of Australia's security document. Using a law like this, citizens will be brought before courts for political reasons rather than security reasons. The reach of this law is not defined and constricted to security, and that's the problem with it." So that whole kind of argument really implies that if these laws were about security, then actually they would be fine. Actually, all of the kind of new surveillance techniques that ASIO and other people are using, the new capacity to arrest and detain terror suspects for days without legal representation, holding people in solitary confinement, all of that would actually be fine and good so long as it was genuinely about aiding and tightening Australian security. So here, really, the Greens are hoist on their own petard. In accepting that terrorism is a major threat in the world, and the threat is not actually the likes of very civilised forces and people like John Howard, who only use state-sanctioned terror, they have to really concede that some security laws are needed, like something's needed in the world. You know, some military force, some economic sanctions, all of these, some measures actually genuinely have to be taken to fight terrorism. So to conclude, there are a number of reasons why the Greens capitulate to imperialism. Their first is their desire for parliamentary power, which leads them to want to maintain respectability and coalitions with more explicitly right-wing forces. The second is their failure to orient to organised working class, which means that they do not take any principled and inevitable stand on the side of workers' rights across national boundaries. The third is that they make concessions to nationalism. So they accept that within any kind of given nation there is one national interest, which leads them to want to pursue Australian business interests, which inevitably leads to imperial conflict. So both the Greens and their whole kind of orientation towards Parliament and so on, as well as the politics that actually informs that orientation, leads pretty much inevitably down the road to imperialism. And yet, in the face of all of that, the face of the patent failure of the Greens to actually be able to mobilise serious anti-imperialist campaign in Australia, the need for that kind of organisation is just as urgent as ever. Because Australia, while not being a kind of world superpower, the likes of the US or China, is still a very significant player in the world. It acts as a crucial backer to the US's bloody imperial dreams and hopes. And in the face of that, it is absolutely vital that there are organisations that are clear that the current conflicts that have engulfed sections of the Middle East and are threatening to rapidly spread across the rest of the world in the name of the war on terror are absolutely nothing but an excuse for imperialism. And what's more, we need organisations that are able to see that imperialism always involves an offensive by the employing class, by the people who have an interest in launching wars overseas on their own populations in the forms of attacks on civil rights, racism and decimating working and living conditions.